From the Sky News Centre at 6. Prince Harry has led the country in remembering the fallen on Armistice Day, laying a wreath at the National Memorial Arboretum. After paying his respects, he read aloud the words of The Soldier by poet Rupert Brooke.
If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England.
Boris Johnson has called on European leaders to stop their collective whinging over the US election. The Foreign Secretary says they should embrace the Trump administration. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
East and west, just points of the compass, each as stupid as the other. I'm a member of Spectre.
Spectre?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Royal British Legion, but why are they taking money from arms companies? Amidst the controversy in football over the FIFA banning the poppy from football t-shirts, we also recognise that it's Armistice Day today and Remembrance Sunday on Sunday. So it's the time, this time of the year, where Veterans for Peace get together every year for their annual conference. Also, British journalist Vanessa Beely is hot foot from Aleppo. She's been telling a very different story to Channel 4 News about what's going on there. Millions of our taxpayers' money being spent propping up Al-Qaeda terrorists, the so-called Al-Nusra rebels, who are holding civilians as human shields. What we're seeing on our TV screens is bearing little resemblance to what's happening on the ground in Syria. Also, another great film this week, which still hasn't been shown on our televisions, Shadow World, about the global arms trade and how it's corrupted politics right across the planet. And the religion of war. We look back to the last Republican president, George W. Bush's Iraq victory speech, how hollow those words seem now. With the suspended Professor Anthony Hall from Canada. Sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2, noon every Tuesday this week. A bit more from Vanessa Beany too, and also the best of the Bath Buskers. But first, I'm joined on the line by James Floren. He's a former infantry soldier in the British Army. Hi, James, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, good evening. Thank you for having me on.
James, tell us a little bit about yourself. How come you got involved in Veterans for Peace?
I've been involved in Veterans for Peace for some time now. I've got a background in the Army, the British Army. I was in the Royal Gloucestershire, Berkshire and Wiltshire Regiment. And I joined Veterans for Peace because of their message, because they moved me, they spoke out to me. It's very significant that there's a Veterans Peace movement, for who knows war better than the veterans that have fought there. And who knows the monster of war better than the veterans that have been through it. And Veterans for Peace are one of the only groups, if not the only group in the world today, that consists of soldiers, sailors, air personnel that have been through war, and that can speak from a grounded position out against war. So they really reached out to me. And I've reached out to them as well.
Well, look, let's scroll back a little bit to your past. Why did you join the infantry in the first place?
I was homeless, jobless, and my fiance had just dumped me. So I was in my 20s, which is a little bit older than most recruits. They're usually teenagers. I like to think of myself as a kind of old-style recruit from Queen Victoria's age, where it used to be called conscription by starvation.
So what do you mean by that?
Kind of unpacking that a bit, it The British Army has usually maintained a regular professional force, but they recruit from the most vulnerable people in society. People that can't afford to eat, people that can't put a roof over their heads, the rejects of modern society, if you like.
So I suppose you could say that some of the austerity measures, taking away people's benefits, etc., is going to actually help with recruitment.
It may do, possibly. We don't know. We're hoping that it won't. We're hoping that young people today are a bit more sophisticated, perhaps a bit more switched on, and a bit more aware of what the armed forces actually means and does. They lie to us. They tell us, join the army, see the world, play sports, have a great adventure. They don't tell you about the downside, which is that you go to war, that you kill people, and that you could be killed yourself.
What about today? It's Armistice Day. What does that mean for people like you in Veterans for Peace?
Well, Armistice Day is an interesting point because it was revived in the late 1990s by a group called the Western Front Association to coincide with the 80th anniversary of the armistice. And there are around 100 veterans of the Great War left alive. And it was more a kind of nod to them, a respect to these guys that were getting very old and dying off very quickly. It was the last significant anniversary, if you like, of the Great War, where survivors could take part and remember their dead pals. But it's been carried on. For some reason, we still remember Armistice Day in the United Kingdom. We stop for 2 minutes. We're invited to, anyway, by the powers that be. So it seems quite bizarre that we are invited to remember something that's out of living memory, if you like. Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, surely it's even more important that we remember the sacrifices made in the past and also maybe learn from those mistakes.
Oh, absolutely, but we can do that in other ways. We don't have to partake in any kind of establishment organised, very military-centric style of remembrance. We have schools, we have an education system, we have libraries, we have books available to us, we have lots of information where the mistakes of the past and the successes of the past can be learned from.
What about there seems to be a bit of an attempt, doesn't there, conflate things like the Second World War, where we are trying to stop the tyranny, Hitler's tyranny, which was rolling the tanks, rolling across Europe, etc., and the British playing a quite important role in that and actually stopping that the hideous things like the concentration camp methods, the Gestapo methods, and Hitler's ideology, you know, being so horrific at the time, and conflate that with the more modern invasions like Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an interesting point. I would have to point out that Veterans for Peace, our slogan is, war is not the answer to the problems of the 21st century. The 20th century is over, it's finished. It's in the history books, we can't change that. As I kind of touched on before, we can certainly learn the lessons. But it's an age-old trick that the powers that be, that the some sections of the mass media, people in control, always like to kind of paint their bad guy, if you like, as another Hitler. He's the sort of benchmark, the gold standard of the nasty person. President Nasser was called that in 1956, prior to the Suez invasion. Saddam Hussein was called another Hitler in 2002, prior to the invasion of Iraq. So it's a very sort of tricky point that we all have to, as movements, as people in the media, as people with consciences, it's a message that we have to pick apart, if you like, and question.
Also, these more modern conflicts, the David Cameron actually himself comparing Putin to Hitler.
Absolutely, yeah. Every perceived bad guy, every leader that doesn't fit in with, let's call it Western policy, is painted or dressed up as a Hitler. It's fascinating, and it's very uncomfortable as well, personally speaking.
Martin, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with us too, James. Martin, I wonder what you make of this, because it does seem that this kind of fits in with the kind of a propaganda model where we're going to be hearing from a little while from Syria, direct really, with Vanessa Bealey, who's been in Aleppo, talking about what's happening over there. And she, one of the things she says is that actually what's happening on the ground has got really nothing to do with what we're hearing seeing night after night on our television screens.
Well, if you think about the history of the Second World War, the lesson that people thought they'd learned from the Second World War is that you have to confront aggression early rather than wait and appease the aggressor. But, of course, we're also forgetting the message of the First World War, which is that everybody grandstands in a belligerent fashion. You can end up with a conflict which nobody really wants, but you end up with it because everybody just backs themselves into a corner where they can't back down. And in actual fact, everybody comparing all these other people to Hitler is basically a historical anachronism. Hitler was Hitler, and comparing Putin to Hitler or Saddam Hussein to Hitler is absurd. And at the same time, of course, you know, we could compare the Saudis to Hitler, who have just invaded Yemen, killing loads of people. That would be silly. The Saudis aren't Hitler. The Saudis are a nasty regime, supported by us, armed by us, trained by our military, but they're not Hitler. They're Saudi Arabia.
Also, James, there's been an article just come out this week, in fact, about the Royal British Legion, and I wonder what you make of it. The Tower of London's blood-swept lands and seas of red armistice display, which was on display last year at the Tower of London, made a significant profit for hedge fund investor who helped finance it. Ben Whitfield, former executive of Olympia Capital Management, made between £2 and £3 million, while artist Paul Cummings took home £7.2 million, which would have made him quite a hefty profit. After other costs, such as 1.36 for the tower management organisation, etc., etc., it just seems as if hedge fund... Why are we in a situation where someone like a hedge fund manager is making so much money personally from this event at the Tower of London with all these poppies, where actually the Royal British Legion is supposed to be a charity?
Yeah, war is good business. It's good business for the arms manufacturers, and now it's good business. Remembrance has become good business as well. The Royal British Legion make huge amounts of money. I'm not sure how much actually goes to the veterans of war or the sufferers of war or the orphans of war or the widows of war, but I know the directors make huge sums of money themselves. They pay advertising companies and the advertising executives huge sums to do very slick adverts proclaiming who they are, what they're about, and that kind of gets siphoned off as well. It's become an industry. War is an industry. Remembrance is now an industry. And it affects the whole national psyche. I'd like to say that I myself, I'm homeless. I'm staying in a veterans hostel, a hostel for ex-soldiers in East London. But that's provided by a charity, a very small charity called Veterans Aid. It's not provided by the Royal British Legion. It's not provided by the British government.
Also, I mean, just to point out on the figures on the Tower of London blood-swept lands and seas of red display, that a third of the money raised by last year's Tower of London actually went to charity, Martin. So two-thirds went to the people that helped finance it and the various people behind the marketing of it.
Yeah.
Well, indeed, I think that's, that speaks for itself. I understand that the Royal British Legion's Articles of Association say that they will campaign for the abolition of war. They were set up in the 1920s, and at one stage, wearing a red poppy on Armistice Day was definitely not seen as a pro-war statement. I don't think that that's necessarily the case today. I think that people's attitudes towards it have evolved, and not necessarily in a positive direction.
Also, there's another rather serious aspect to the way the Royal British Legion operates, and that is to do with the people that they take money from. Lockheed Martin, who are big arms manufacturers from the United States, the biggest arms manufacturer in Britain, BAE Systems, Thales, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, T-H-A-L-E-S, more arms firms. I mean, surely there, you have a view on whether you think this is right, because I remember I found this article about this on your Veterans for Peace website, James.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. The Royal British Legion takes money from whoever will give it money. It's very much involved in the warfare state, as we call it. It's very much involved in militarism. It's very much involved in the war system, if you like. It's very much involved in promoting the culture of war and the cult of the military, something that we see has risen in the last 10 or 20 years, almost again by the powers that be, to try and justify the wars that are being fought overseas. And it's very mendacious of them, in a surreptitious way, to take money from the warmongers, from the people that are making the devices, making the equipment to kill people, to kill women, to kill children.
Now, Robert Fisk, he's a journalist that's been reporting on the Middle East in various British outlets for decades now. He doesn't appear on the BBC because the BBC don't want him on, but also because he has said publicly that whenever the BBC, they phone him up for a possible interview, they say, well, what will you say if you come on? And then they decide whether to have him on, determining what he's going to say beforehand. And so they only want him to say what they want him to say. So obviously that's one of the reasons you won't see Robert Fisk on the BBC, even though he's one of the greatest Middle East reporters and journalists in the world. The poppy, he says, has become a symbol of racism. I will never wear one again. The Entente Cordiale, which sent his father to France, is now trash beneath the high heels of Theresa May, yet this wretched woman dares to wear a poppy. That's what Robert Fisk is saying this year, Thursday the 3rd of November. That's just actually towards the end of last week. And he says, yes, the boys and girls of the BBC and ITV and all our lively media and sports personalities and politicians are at it again. They're flaunting their silly poppies once more to show their super correctness in the face of history, and ignorant as or forgetful as ever that their tired fashion accessory was inspired by a poem which urged the soldiers of the Great War to go on killing and slaughtering. But that's no longer quite the point, for I fear there are now darker reasons why these TV chumps and their MP interviewees sport their red compassion badges on their clothes. For who are they commemorating? The dead of Sarajevo, of Srebrenica, of Aleppo? No. The television bumpkins only shed their crocodile tears for the dead of First and Second World Wars, who were, save for a colonial war or two, the last generation of Britons to get the chop before the new age of we bomb you die technology ensured that their chaps, brown-eyed for the most part, often Muslims, usually dark-skinned, got blown to bits while our chaps flew safely home to the mess for breakfast. Yes, he's raging against the poppy disgrace every year, and his father, who was 12th Battalion of the King's Liverpool Regiment, 3rd Battle of the Somme, the liberating of burning Cambrai in 1918, finally abandoned the poppy charade when he learned of the hypocrisy and lies behind the war in which he fought. Now, James, that's pretty tough language.
Yeah, it's not for nothing that Robert Fisk is one of our greatest journalists and greatest war reporters. He's entitled to his own opinions, as we all are. He's entitled to wear a poppy or throw the poppy away. But let's not forget that after the Great War, almost immediately after, when there were Armistice Day parades, there were 24,000 veterans of the Great War that marched past a cenotaph wearing pawn tickets in their lapels because they couldn't afford to eat, they couldn't afford to feed their children, they couldn't afford to put roofs over their heads. And this was in the land fit for heroes, as Lloyd George described it. There was no land fit for heroes. It was back to the poverty of the Victorian class system. And let's not also forget that these same veterans, shortly after the First World War, broke the two-minute silence that's held on Armistice Day in a protest about the way that their lives were falling apart after serving their country and going to war and seeing their friends blown to pieces and ripped apart.
Now, to give the other side of this, Stuart Gendall, who's the corporate communication manager of the British Legion, said a couple of years ago of the sponsorship by armed firms, that money allows us to carry the work we need to do. Is a regrettable reality that war continues. The British Armed Forces require equipment, and BAE supplies much of that equipment. Without the best quality tools to do the job, we would be remembering more casualties of conflict. The British Legion spends £48 million, a couple of years ago this was, every year on counselling, small business and welfare grants, home and hospital visits and nursing. A spokesman for BAE defended its decision to support the Poppy Appeal. He said, for probably the whole of the last century, we have provided equipment for the British Armed Forces. It doesn't seem entirely unusual we should sponsor the Royal British Legion in the way in which we have. After all, we are the legacy company that made the Spitfire, the Lancaster, and many of the ships of the Royal Navy. The Royal British Legion are all about remembering the war dead. This is a charitable donation, James.
Yeah, I mean, that's all very well, but the best way to save lives and protect the lives of British soldiers is never to send them to war again. We've been involved in so many wars. There's only been one year, I believe, in 1968, that a British soldier or member of the armed forces hasn't died in battle. It's a hypocrisy, and it's a disgrace to say that. We believe in Veterans for Peace, that the United Kingdom has been aggressors all over the world. There's only 20 odd countries that we haven't invaded or been to war with. If you look at a map of the world and you colour those countries in, it's absolutely phenomenal.
Hang on, you're going back to the Empire days now. We're not really responsible for that, are we?
Well, there's kind of one could argue that there might be neo-colonialism happening. If you look at countries that we're at war with now, that's as a result of our imperial conquests, certainly in the Middle East in particular. Palestine was under our mandate, and so were many other countries.
Also, of course, Martin, the Americans have kind of taken over where the British Empire left off, haven't they? I mean, they took over in the Middle East, effectively, at the end of the Second World War, with Roosevelt going in there and doing deals with the Saudi Arabians at the end of World War II.
Yeah, well, I think I feel very ambivalent about Armistice Day, because I don't think there's very few people who are complete pacifists, and I wouldn't include myself amongst them. But in actual fact, the problem is that we've been fighting on the wrong side in many of these wars, and we are the guilty parties. For example, BAE Systems is at the moment supplying weaponry which we trained them to use in Saudi Arabia, where they're carrying out bombing raids which are designed to terrorise the civilian population of that country. And that is going on. We're based in Bristol here. That's all started right here in Bristol. BAE Systems used to belong to the British government, as most Russian military industry still belongs to the government. Now, if the industry belonged to the government, then it wouldn't be a position to give charitable donations, because the government, you know, that would be absurd for the government to give charitable donations. They would have to, the government itself should provide support for veterans, and it shouldn't have to rely on charity. Okay. But BAE Systems is a profit making exercise. It's not a nationalised industry. It ought to be.
The warfare state, as you said, James. So anyway, just take us through, finally, what Veterans for Peace are up to this weekend.
We've got our annual general conference, and we're 400 veterans that represent every war that Britain's fought in since the Second World War. We even have a D-Day veteran, a chap who was the youngest person on D-Day. Was a 15-year-old sailor, and we come together, we discuss what we're about, what we stand for, what our campaigns are. We've also got our sort of cousins from the United States. The Veterans for Peace was started up in the United States following the Vietnam War. So we've had US Veterans for Peace visiting us as well. Tomorrow we've got a public conference. This is all down at the Quakers Centre in London, in Euston. And particularly the kind of highlight, if you like, the centrepiece of our annual general conference is Remembrance Sunday, when we kind of line up and we lay the only wreath of white poppies at the cenotaph.
What's the significance of the white poppy as against the red one? Obviously, the red one is the British Legion, which we've been slating here, really, as being in bed with the arms industry.
Yeah, well, the white poppy was started up by the Peace Pledge Union just after the First World War, And it remembers chiefly, well, kind of commemorates or salutes, to use a military term, all dead. The Royal British Legion just want us to remember, in inverted commas, the British and Commonwealth armed forces dead. Not civilians, not the dead from other countries, just British soldiers, sailors and airmen. But the white poppy remembers everyone. But it's also for peace as well. It calls for peace. Whereas the Royal British Legion red poppy, we feel, in some way, has begun to promote war, particularly in the last 10 or 15 years.
Just finally, I did say finally, but Martin, you know, we're in a very strange situation now with the British Legion, aren't we? Because this is an organisation that, as you said, as part of its rule, it's about remembering mistakes from the past, not making those mistakes again, and now it's actually being fuelled financially by the people who profit from aggressive invasions of other countries and the dismantling of the UN Charter, for example.
Well, indeed, but I think I would regard the British Legion as a site of struggle. It's an ambivalent organisation, but I've got much more time for the British Legion than I've got for things like Help for Heroes, which really have no anti-war agenda at all. That was set up by the Murdoch press to support British imperialist intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. The British Legion, I think, has got a better reputation and is a more honourable organisation, and I think they need to act. That people who are active in the British Legion need to look at things like taking money from arms companies and consider whether it is appropriate.
James, I'm just thinking there may be people listening who have got veteran friends in their family that are also pretty annoyed about the way that the British Armed Forces have been being projected around as a kind of on the coattails of the Americans over the last 20, 30 years. I mean, it was in the 1970s, wasn't it? Harold Wilson famously said, no, we're not having British troops going to Vietnam. But it seems that we've been pretty much following the Pentagon ever since and continue to do so in many ways. So how can people find Veterans for Peace and sort of, you know, get people who are veterans to join your organisation?
Well, we've got a good presence on the internet. We have a webpage, vfpuk.org. We've also got a Facebook page as well, Veterans for Peace UK. That's distinct from the American Veterans for Peace. And if people click on there, they can find out more information. We've got several articles that guys have written. We have phone numbers on there. We have various contact points and people that can help with information, if you like.
Okay, James Foran from Veterans for Peace UK. Have a very good Remembrance Sunday. Thanks very much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you. All the best. Take care. Bye-bye.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, that was a fascinating discussion there, I think, about the sort of more modern, sort of certainly, you know, we get the impression, Martin, don't we, that so the whole of the armed forces are behind these things, and often soldiers, quite rightly, whilst they're on duty, shut up about what they're doing. But it seems increasingly there are some that are not prepared to carry on doing that. Anyway, Obama is directing the Pentagon to target al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, one of the most formidable forces fighting Assad. Now, this is in the Washington Post today. This almost looks as if there's a beginning to be a shift already in US foreign policy, possibly after the election of Donald Trump, if the al-Qaeda affiliates like al-Nusra in Syria are being targeted by the Americans.
Well, there's an awful lot of disinformation. We're supposedly targeting ISIS, but our allies Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey have been supporting ISIS with weaponry. There's no dispute about that. And of course, there's also a lot of indications that we ourselves have been supporting them. So this is a lot of grandstanding. We've got a situation now where it's becoming rather embarrassing that our allies in Syria are actually al-Qaeda, who we've supposedly been fighting a war against on several continents for the last 20 years. But in actual fact, it's not that such a problem at all. We are being manipulated. So we create these terrorist organisations and then we pretend to fight them. And the purpose of all of it is to make sure that we can stick our finger in
kind of
and steer geopolitics in the direction.
You kind of miss the point of what I'm saying if Obama is now saying that al-Nusra in Syria has got to be attacked by Americans.
Well, I'll believe it when I see it. is all I can say. Because up to now, there's been a pretty solid drumbeat from the Western media that these guys are heroic rebels and that we ought to be supporting them. Now, it may be that there is going to be a change in US policy. If there was, I'm quite sure that plenty of people in Russia and in Syria would welcome it. But whether it's actually going to happen,
The Washington Post says it will be. Do you think Trump is going to change the way that we see the America? He has actually said, hasn't he, that the America can't afford to be the policeman of the world anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, the America isn't the policeman of the world. America is the gangster of the world. That's the problem. And the self-regard of the US political class for itself, they see themselves as bearing the white man's burden, as it were, in all these countries. And in these countries, they're not seen as the police force. They're seen as the gangsters. And that's a huge step that they need to take. They don't, you know, Trump wants to, I mean, ordinary people in America don't want to get involved in all these fights, quite right, but they don't realise that they are involved in these fights and that they're not turning up as the police and bearing a burden. I mean, they are actually forcing everybody else into line, like Western European countries, for example. They don't want to be part of NATO. They're made to be part of NATO so that we can keep so that the Russians can be kept out of Europe and the Americans can continue to dominate the economy.
James was saying there very clearly that there is a massive financial incentive these days. In fact, probably there already was in war, and this is extremely worrying. And one of the people that's written very, very well about this, in fact, probably the definitive book over the last 10 years or so, is the title of the book is The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade by a former MP in South Africa for the ANC, Andrew Feinstein. And there's a film out recently all about this. Of course, it's not been shown on our TV screens, but let's hear a clip from it now. It's called Shadow World.
I got nothing against money. I don't mind paying bribes to politicians. The thing about politicians is that they're very much like prostitutes, but only more expensive.
The heads of government are the salespeople in chief of their country's large arms contractors.
For the last 50 years at least, policy has been made based on the assumption of greed, and it's ruined the world.
This very phrase, war on terror, it's nonsense. It's like saying a war on war. You're slipping into this possibility of kind of perpetual war.
The national security state not only seeks a perpetual state of war, it will even go to all ends to create that.
They make the mafia look like a bunch of schoolboys.
And it destroys diplomacy. It destroys the will to diplomacy, and it destroys the skill for diplomacy.
Bombs, they're like food. Munitions that's got, you know, sell by that. You gotta get rid of it.
Blair came to South Africa to lobby that BAE, the British weapons manufacturer, won the biggest contract, $10 billion. Quite scarce public resources on this weaponry that we didn't need. And this is the template around the world.
BAE had channeled international covert payments all over the world to the local politicians.
Seems to be a very expensive way of organising bribe payment. Might as well cut out the military equipment and just hand out the money.
It's the disease of permanent war that destroyed the Middle East, not Islamic fundamentalism.
Companies are not only sort of part of the government, but they're effectively above the law.
It's okay to kill from a distance without a warrant, without a trial, without a jury, and the execution takes place off screen.
Once you start a war, you open a kind of Pandora's box. You don't control it, it controls you. And it propels you in directions you never thought you'd go.
Well, that's just a few clips there from the trailer of the film Shadow World. Martin reveals, it says, the shocking realities of the global arms trade, the only business that counts its profits in billions and its losses in human lives. Directed by John Grompres and part based on Corruption Watch UK founder Andrew Feinstein's globally acclaimed book, The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade. Film reveals how the international trade in weapons, with the complicity of governments, intelligence agencies, investigative and prosecutorial bodies, weapons manufacturers, dealers and agents, fosters corruption, determines economic and foreign policies, undermines democratic democracy, and creates widespread suffering. Well, of course, we like to think that the corruption goes on in countries in Africa and places like that, but actually the heart of it is here in Britain in many ways, Martin.
It is. If you look at something, a country like Saudi Arabia, for example, which Transparency International sees as a much more corrupt country than Britain, and even a country like South Africa, or many other countries that we deal with, they are accused of being corrupt because they take bribes from our arms companies. But we're not corrupt. They're corrupt. It's a kind of racist inversion. Britain, the British arms industry and the British financial services industry are the heart, the centre of global corruption. We are right at the heart of global corruption here.
And also,
in this country.
I mean, we've been talking quite a lot since the top of the hour about propaganda, the sort of thing we get through Channel 4 News. I think nowadays, I don't know about you, but I'm quite suspicious whenever I see a child or a dying child, that sort of thing put on the TV screen. It almost always seems to be someone who is a victim of one of our enemies rather than the balanced reporting. So this is a little bit cynical, isn't it, where children are used as a propaganda tool like this. I mean, I don't think anyone would mind if it was both sides, but it's not.
No, it isn't. And we're being constantly emotionally manipulated by psychological warfare techniques. And of course, children, we are biologically programmed to feel emotion when we see children being hurt or distressed. I work in a primary school,
so
I know what it's about.
Hitting us in the subconscious.
Yes,
basically.
It is. And of course, the fact of the matter is we see a tiny fraction of what's really going on. There are no white helmets embedded with the Houthi rebels in Yemen to show us horrific photos of the aftermath, for example, of the attack on the funeral that killed 150 people a few weeks ago, the funeral, incidentally, of a very high-ranking rebel leader, and they knew that all of the people who he's allied with would be at that funeral, which is why they attacked the funeral. But, of course, we didn't see any pictures of that. No blood, no tears, nothing, because we don't really need to know about that war. That's a good war. That's a war you don't need to know about. But, of course, we're going to see the pictures of Aleppo from the White Helmets, which we fund, of course. We fund the White Helmets, who are embedded with the al-Nusra Front. So if the RAF, for example, tried to bomb the al-Nusra Front in Aleppo, they'd probably kill some white helmets.
Or the Americans.
Yeah. They've got no right to bomb anybody in Syria at all under international law, at all, because they've not been invited in there.
We've got Vanessa Bealey. We're going to hear from her now. She was doing a talk in Bristol this time last week, but I managed to catch her earlier this week with a bit of help from the Frome Stop the War group, speaking about exactly what you were saying, actually, Martin, which is the White Helmets and how both they and the British media are now becoming embedded in Aleppo with the terrorists themselves.
When you need the fire engine or when you need first responders in Syria, you call 113, exactly the same as, I hope it's still 999 in Britain. I haven't lived here for a while. There is no number for the White Helmets. There's nobody you can actually call. So that begs the question, well, what do people do who are in trouble? How do they get in touch with White Helmets? Or are they working purely as triage and support for the terrorist organisations with whom they're embedded? So the real Syria Civil Defence, who work in both terrorist and government-held areas, by the way, many of them have lost their lives going into terrorist-held areas to rescue civilians from under mortar fire or under guided missile attacks. The terrorist factions, by the way, to the north of Aleppo, particularly the ones in Idlib, to the north of Aleppo. There are three particular brigades, 13th Division, the Mountain Hawks, and I can never remember the third one, are heavily funded by the CIA, trained by the CIA, and armed by the CIA. And they now have Grad missiles, which will come in from Bulgaria and Tunisia, among other countries. And these Grad missiles are now being used also against the northern areas of Aleppo, the city itself and the surrounding countryside. And these missiles are used against these first responders. When they go into terrorist-held areas, what is happening is that the militant factions are picking them off. For instance, we have here the remains of a fire truck that went to a call-out in Homs. This is actually from the real Syria Civil Defence headquarters in Damascus. They went to respond to a call from Homs to a civilian area that was under attack from the terrorist factions. As they drove into the mortar-hit area, they were actually hit by a guided missile, and all three crew members were wiped out instantly. This is, again, to me, this is part of the criminal activity by our government to destroy the Syrian institutions, the Syrian humanitarian institutions, the Syrian state institutions that are so cohesive inside Syria. It's an extraordinary thing to witness. The Syrian state's efforts to keep supplying its civilians, to maintain its infrastructure, despite one, crippling economic sanctions that affect the real Syria Civil Defence but do not affect the White Helmets. The White Helmets have no issue getting equipment into Idlib, by the way, from Turkey, from EU through Turkey and into Idlib. And then it's distributed to the White Helmet centres across the terrorist-held areas. They are not affected by the sanctions. These guys are. The real Syria Civil Defence, if they run out of something, they don't get any replacement. For instance, the real Syria Civil Defence in West Aleppo are dealing with chemical attacks almost on a weekly basis from the terrorists in East Aleppo. The reasons they lost one of their crew members, Mohammed Ibish, age 36, on the 2nd of August. Why? Because they have no gas masks. They haven't been able to replace them. So all they have are the paper masks, which are no defence against mustard gas, chlorine, any sort of chemical weapons that are being used against them in West Aleppo. And so, you know, this is a common occurrence, is that the Syrian state institutions are battling the crippling economic sanctions, the intervention from NATO, which includes the invasion by proxy forces, and of course hostile propaganda, hostile diplomacy. This is Engineer Saad. He is based in the Damascus headquarters of the Real Syria Civil Defence, which, as we drove up to it, you have Jaish al-Islam directly and in front of you, about 50 metres away, and to the left you have Jobar, which is a very well-known terrorist-held area. So this entire centre is under attack on a regular basis. Every time they go out to respond to a call, they are driving through terrorist-held areas. This guy was hit. You can see his left hand is it's hanging. It's paralysed. He was hit in one of the attacks on the centre. He was operated on for about 8 hours, and he still has no movement in that hand. This ambulance, for example, was stripped clean by the terrorists, and they've been unable to replace any of the equipment in it, any of the life-saving equipment in it. So it's useless as an ambulance. When I was in West Aleppo and I was speaking with the Real Syria Civil Defence there, what they also told me, there were members of the crew there who came from East Aleppo to West Aleppo, and they told me that when the terrorists came in 2012, they massacred crew members, they kidnapped others. One of those crew members that I spoke to had been told if he stayed, he had to work with the terrorists. He refused, he fled. They burnt down his house, they put his name on all of the checkpoints so that if he were to come back, he would be assassinated. And his family, who had to be left behind in East Aleppo, are under constant risk of execution. What he also told me was that those terrorists that came in 2012 then were transformed into the White Helmets. But he categorically said to me, they are not humanitarian workers, they are terrorists, they are armed, and they are working alongside the terrorists. Another very clear example, Real Syria Civil Defence is a member of the International Civil Defence Organisation. Just prior to the Nobel Peace Prize announcement, the link to the Syrian Arab Republic, Syrian Civil Defence, was broken and reconnected to the White Helmets by surprise. So luckily we noticed it, and we phoned them, and this was a conversation that I actually had with the ICDO. We ran through basically what had happened. He said it was an administrative mistake, fair enough. But the interesting fact that came out of it was that they do not recognise, and neither does the UN, They do not recognise the White Helmet as a first responder civil defence organisation. Very important fact. As I mentioned, when you go to the White Helmet funding page, you'll see a very clear meme which shows all of the equipment and how you should be funding it. Well, that's very interesting if they were to be affected by the economic sanctions that is affecting every single other Syrian institution. However, as I mentioned to you, the White Helmets seem to be immune to sanctions. Then let's have a quick look at another media organisation, Channel 4. A very recent video that they put out and then very quickly took down. I don't know if anybody actually noticed this, but this is indicative of Channel 4's reporting on the crisis in Syria. They've run with a very NATO-aligned narrative. They've become very bullish. In fact, I mentioned today, they've become the Fox News of UK media to a huge extent. They bully their interviewees. They maintain their propaganda line even when faced with evidence to the contrary. And in this particular video...
It's early morning and they're planning an attack. Their way of defending East Aleppo is to hit back by sending suicide bombers to the Syrian army. And by launching rockets into the west side of the city.
They just normalise suicide bombers and attacks on civilians in West Aleppo. That was just completely nonchalantly put into the report as if it's perfectly normal that suicide bombers should be used as a legitimate weapon against the indigenous national army, or that it's normal that they defend themselves by attacking civilians in West Aleppo. But that's not the worst part of this video. The actual stars of this video were the beheadings of 12-year-old Abdullah Issa. So Channel 4 is telling you that child beheaders and executors and torturers are rebels and deserve to defend themselves against the civilians of West Aleppo by mortaring them, by sniping them, by explosive bullets. Extraordinary, I find that extraordinary. Here's another identification. So these are the actual beheaders. They're not even just associated with Nur al-Din Zinki. They are the actual executors of that child. Now, when this was pointed out to Channel 4, and when in fact Channel 4 was attacked for this video, they immediately took it down. Fortunately, many of us took a copy of it. And then in among these nice beheading operatives that they called rebels, we find, guess what? The White Helmets. Again, this is completely ignored by Channel 4. It's not even picked up on that somebody that has just been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize is running alongside child beheaders in East Aleppo carrying weapons. Great media we have.
That's Vanessa Bealey there speaking in Froome, actually, on Wednesday evening. Martin, it's just another unit of the British Army, it seems, Channel 4 News.
Well, I mean, the Channel 4 News are not the only ones who are spreading these lies and disinformation, are they? I think it's very... But the White Helmets themselves were set up by James Le Mesurier, who's an ex-British intelligence officer based in Turkey, and we are funding them. But we are funding them to take videos which supposedly show the sufferings of the people of East Aleppo, but Channel 4 News went a little one step further there, where they actually show them mortaring and attacking the civilians of West Aleppo, where most of the people have fled to escape from their clutches. We are embedded with those people who are actually Al-Qaeda, who were supposedly the people who carried out the 9/11 attack, and why we've been gone to war in several countries over the last 20 years is to defeat Al-Qaeda, even though the British Army's psychological warfare operation is working with them in East Aleppo.
Interesting, yeah. Also this week, ISIS hunters, the SAS, are to track and kill British citizens in Iraq. British citizens affiliated to jihadist groups in Iraq will be hunted down as part of a new kill or capture strategy, according to senior defence sources here in Britain. A list of UK citizens that features around 200 jihadists currently at large in Iraq has been compiled by the US's intelligence agencies. The Times was told a kill list has been drawn up containing the numbers of hundreds of very bad people. A lot of them are from the UK. The hunt is now on for the British Islamists, who have effectively gone off-grid, an anonymous spokesperson for the MOD told the Times.
Well, I find this fascinating because it's quite possible, as we've uncovered on this show in the past, that it is the Western intelligence agencies, particularly the Turks, who have been recruiting people and pushing them in to Syria and Iraq of British and other origins, and now we're pretending that we're going to hunt them down. Now, there's an element of basically make-believe associated with all of this. We know that ISIS and the al-Nusra Front are armed and trained by our own allies, but we don't try and stop our allies arming and training them. We pretend to go hunting them.
One of the places that Vanessa Beely said is absolutely clear is one of the most important for recruiting and fueling and keeping ISIS going is this town called Gaziantep, which is in southern Turkey near to the Syrian border.
Indeed, and those the Turkish army are our allies, and their chaps are all chained at Sandhurst, and they are the ones who are taking these British citizens and infiltrating them into Syria to fight the Syrian army, and then we pretend that we're going in after them to try and capture them. It's all a lot of smoke and mirrors.
And of course, we've reported on this show, and I finally managed to get it was actually Redress Online. Thank you very much. It finally published my article about Khadija Sultana and these three East London schoolgirls from Bethnal Green Academy who were trafficked over to Turkey and then helped by Canadian intelligence down to Gaziantep. And who did they meet? Well, they met a chap called Ibrahim Baki. He's a jihadist terrorist, but he's an English guy down in Gaziantep.
Yes, and he's quite likely working for MI6. So what we're doing is we're creating jihadist rebels, and we're recruiting them from all over the world, as we did in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and then we pretend to go and catch them, which means that we've got an excuse to intervene in Syria, even though we've got no right to be there at all.
And you might say, well,
the local government doesn't want us.
You might well say, well, why do these people want to work for British intelligence? Well, what they do is they offer them, amazingly enough, they say to them, well, you can have British citizenship or Canadian citizenship if you work for us. And of course, they're in a war-torn part of the country. Do they want to make this horrible migrant refugee trip right across Europe to try and make it to Britain, or they just work for MI6 and they get a free ticket into the country? But what are MI6 doing? This is their recruiting, effectively, what people who could be jihadists there.
Well, the implication,
and bringing them into Britain.
The implication is that many of the terrorist attacks at Nice, Brussels and elsewhere are actually being orchestrated from within NATO's intelligence structure. And they've been doing things like that going back to the 1940s, the Bologna bombing in Italy in 1980, according to the Italian police, etc. And when we have people like Yvette Cooper going on about how wonderful NATO is and how we must preserve it at all costs, does she know the real history of NATO and NATO's involvement in both Islamist terrorism and other forms of terrorism? I don't think she does she?
Talking of terrorism, run, hide and tell. This is the Bristol Post again. What to do in the event of a terrorist attack? Police have issued guidance, assuming that's Avon and Somerset Police, on what the public should do in the event of a terrorist attack in Bristol. The information was issued as November the 13th marks the 1 year anniversary of the Paris attacks, where gunmen and suicide bombers, in big inverted commas, we're not quite sure who, killed 130 people. The National Police Chief's Council put out the video, which states people should run, hide and tell in the unlikely event of a terrorist attack. Run to a place of safety. Then hide is better than to hide, then confront and then tell by calling the police on 999. You need a simple message that will be quickly come to you. Run, hide, tell. We know from our research a lot of people are familiar with the message. We want everyone to watch the video and be aware of what we do. Police forces across Britain are training more firearms officers to respond to such threats. We also, didn't we? We heard this week of a shoot to kill in Luton. This is a little bit concerning when the police take call to a domestic incident and just end up killing the guy, shooting him in the neck.
Well, this run, hide and tell philosophy, you could say that's probably quite a sensible thing to do if you caught them in such an incident. But of course, the telling is the important point. In the Nice attack, the CCTV footage of the actual attack, the security services wanted it wiped, because they didn't want any evidence of what had actually happened at the attack. And that's quite possibly because what happened at the attack is not what we're being told.
There's a lot of things. Of course, it's the anniversary this week of the, or next week actually, of the Paris attacks a year ago. There are all sorts of questions still about that, though, aren't there?
Indeed.
One of them, I remember watching a film of interview with the rock band at the Bataclan, and they seemed to be almost smirking as they were being interviewed. I mean, this is horrible. But, I mean, you know, there's no proper investigation, I think, into that.
No, well...
What are your major concerns about that attack?
Well, the Kouachi brothers, who claim to have supposedly been the masterminds of it, they left their passports in the car and then they were immediately rounded up and killed, so we'll never know who or what they were. But what we do know is that Western intelligence services have been recruiting all sorts of people to be infiltrated into Syria to fight the Syrian government, and then these people turn up in Belgium and elsewhere doing nasty things, or supposedly doing nasty things, and taking the blame. We are being manipulated by NATO intelligence services. We've been manipulated for decades. The track record of these people is enormous. The police in some parts of the world are very well aware of what these people are like and what they do. We need independent police investigations of these incidents, and one of the presumptions has to be that the intelligence services are behind these attacks.
Sorry, we haven't got time to hear Anthony Hall. We'll have to do that one next week. His interesting little analysis. He's the guy who's been suspended without pay from his university in Canada about the mission accomplished in Iraq speech by George W. Bush at the end of the Iraq War. We haven't got time for that. But, Martin, I suppose we should really be looking at the wider picture of the media and terrorism, and what we can expect a year on from these Paris attacks, because it's quite clear, as we've heard from the Khadija Sultana case there, with the British and Canadian intelligence services actually inviting jihadists to come to Britain as part of their recruitment into MI6, we are facing a potential Gladio B here, aren't we?
We are indeed, and if anybody wants to know what Gladio are, they can just carry out a search online, and you will see that NATO's intelligence services have a track record of creating terrorism and then pretending to resolve it.
So, okay, well, that's all for this week. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Coming up is Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi, and also thanks very much to infantry soldier James Florin, who was with us just after the news at 6 o'clock. Thanks to our guest also in the first hour, who is Tom Baldwin from the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, and also from Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialect airs on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This week we got more from Vanessa Bealey, and also some busking from Bath. All that from www.dialectradio.co.uk. This show's page is thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
It's Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.